And they must have had an all-day marathon yesterday because they were in here with their sewing machines.
Okay, welcome back to Raising Children Who Love Their Savior. We are finishing up part 5 today, and we're going to take a look at part 6. It takes discipline to become a disciple. Everyone have a copy? Okay, let's begin with prayer. Lord Jesus, show us today the importance of discipline. Make us self-disciplined parents who understand well how to discipline our children in love. Remind us that for each of us to be disciples of you, we need discipline. Help us to view it as a positive thing that's used in a positive way. We ask this in Jesus' name.
With each of the lessons, we've had a section entitled Where the Rubber Meets the Road, and that's what we need to finish off on part 5, which has two rubber meets the road questions at the end. For those of you who got copies today, I put these rubber meets the roads on the back of your number 6. So if you don't have a 5, that's the reason I was giving you a special copy. Look to the back Lesson 6, and I copied them on again. The one we were in the middle of discussing last time was this question: Your son is becoming disrespectful, and it's becoming more and more clear that he is especially talking down to girls. How do you begin to look for the causes that we discussed already? But the second question is the one we need to finish off yet today. And how do you address the problem? We have people who shared with us it could be a problem where maybe the father in the family is being disrespectful to the mother or to women in general. Or we talked too about how he could pick it up from his buddies at school, the people he's hanging around with, right? We want to zero in more now on solutions. What would be a solution to a young man being disrespectful to women? Maybe think about it this way once. What could a father do in that situation when you notice it? What could a mother do in a situation like that?
Well, if mom and dad are still together, mm-hmm. Of course, you mentioned last week that the best example is for the husband to show love for mom all the time anyway.
Right.
But if they're divorced, then what you have to fall back on is getting them, in my opinion, getting them to think in terms of scenarios. Mm-hmm. Hey, if your mom were, Susie or whoever he's talking about, mm-hmm. would you say those same things about her friends?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the things I struggled with the girls was making sure that music choices and the friends that they associated with, as much as I could without doing the helicopter thing, have them think about some of the lyrics and the songs, not we're just mm-hmm. listening to the music, because a lot of the rap music and stuff is very disrespectful mm-hmm. towards women
yes.
and toward relationships in general.
Yes. Yeah.
And just getting them to think yeah. about it is, in my opinion, just kind of how you get started.
Good, good. Gordon, I think, has two solutions there, right? The first one is mom and dad talk to one another. Get on the same page with issues like this, right? Second solution is talk with your children about it, right? Go through, he uses the specific example of music. A lot of rap music, very disrespectful to women, disrespectful to relationships in general, and talk with them about why this is wrong, right? How it is harmful. Two good solutions. He also emphasized in that thing about relationship of father and mother together, the father's role. Remember my phrase last time? Husbands, love your wife. The best thing a husband can do for his children is to love his wife, right? Because it will then trickle down to the children. They will see the love that the father shows to his wife, and they will see that as role modeling, and they will imitate it in their relationships with women.
I don't remember where I heard this one. I can't remember if it was you or something I heard on a self-help tape. But when you walk in the evening after work, mm-hmm. the first thing to do is go over and hug and kiss and greet your wife. Mm-hmm. The dog's wagging and happy to see mm-hmm. you. The kids are too, hopefully.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, it's like, hi, but boom, you just make a beeline for that woman and
yes.
embrace her.
Exactly.
And then
sometimes what seems to us like the little things make a big impact, right? Simply by walking into the house after a day of work and greeting, embracing your wife, giving her a kiss, speaks volumes to the kids, right? That it starts with her. I had a friend one time who, before we were married, said, you know, I think I'm ready for to have kids now, but I'm not sure if I'm ready for a wife. And I thought, what's wrong with this picture? You've got to have the one before you have the other. And if you haven't thought through what that relationship is with that wife, you are not ready to have children. Right? So the little things that you do, husbands, can make a big impact. I would go even further and say things like eye contact, going to your wife and saying, you know, hi honey, how was your day, rather than you know, when you come in, kind of in a grumbly tone or whatever, kids will pick up on that. My father-in-law was a real stickler. My wife and I come from totally different families. And in a way, she comes from a much more cultured background than I do, from the farm in Wisconsin. Her father would not allow the children to refer to their mother as she or her. In any sentence, it was always mom, so that you got this sense of I'm addressing you as a person, rather than to refer to you as a third party in the same room as us. He was that much of a stickler of detail. So these little things like eye contact, tone of voice, word that you use to address this person, very important. Very important. Mm-hmm. Jason?
My mother, not so much her example, but also the comments that she made about other people, especially like TV characters, movie characters, and whatnot, comments she made on how they act made a big impact on me. That might be a way that you could, you know, get these things instead of, like, it's so easy, like, when you see your child doing something, you know, to talk to them and say, you're doing a bad thing.
Yes.
That person. But if you instead, by proxy, just, you know, say, oh, this person is a bad person.
Yes.
I think it's psychologically easier on a child to, you know, not want to do that.
Right. Very good point. And it kind of launches into our second, where the rubber meets the road. If a mother can make a comment about a character on television, there's not as much emotional attachment to that character on television than if the mother says, you know, I don't like that kid you're hanging around with, you know, because then it's hard for the child with the emotional attachment to that friend to see that friend's fault. So Jason has a good piece of advice. If you see bad behavior on a television program, talk with your kids about what that character is doing wrong. John?
Going back to the son being becoming disrespectful, sometimes, I hate to say it, I think some of the girls deserve it nowadays. And if you observe the way some women, some females behave, it's outrageous. So part of checking out when your son starts acting that way, find out, well, what else going on here?
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, I remember walking home from school in eighth grade, and these foul-mouthed girls just walked along, did all kinds of stuff, nasty stuff. That's all they did. And I was trying to avoid it and get away from it. But, and that was, you know, 30 years ago, and it's worse today. And so it's when there's a chance that your son can end up being in a classroom environment where the girls are acting like sluts. And so what do? It becomes a real challenge as a parent. I mean, because the assumption, I think, part of this is that the girls are behaving appropriately. And when they are behaving appropriately, there's no reason. I mean, I'm not justifying that, you know, that your son should be disrespectful to a woman no matter how they behave. But in the current society, there's a good possibility that that the other person is behaving in such a way that is just absolutely outrageous or is absolutely inappropriate, and the son doesn't know how to respond.
I see what you're saying, and I think in general I'm hearing more and more from people that girls are more aggressive, is a word that I'm hearing coming up more and more, that they view themselves differently than they did probably when we were growing up. But I guess I would say too, remember a talk we had a couple of weeks ago where I emphasized how what a Christian needs to understand in how we react to other people is that we don't react to bad behavior in other people and react in kind toward them, but that we need to bring up our children to realize Jesus has been wonderful to me. And it's because of that love that Jesus has shown to me that I now react to these girls in a way that, you know, you see what I'm saying? That is not, I don't have anything to do with you or something like that, but that is loving, you know, you're mixed up, and I want to help you to see why that kind of behavior isn't appropriate. So I think, I understand what you're saying, but I think I would caution you from going too much in that direction with your child, because then it becomes, you're just making your child defensive. I mean, they react to everybody who's evil in the world, rather than, and judgmental, rather than from a sense of peace and I am forgiven, Jesus loves me dearly, you know, and that's how I then proceed with these people who are very hard to live with. Gordon?
There is no justification, especially a young woman or a woman, a certain way because of her behavior.
Okay.
You hit the nail on the head when you said we have to be proactive, not reactive, because we know how to behave. We have an example. We've got a rule book in the Bible. This gets back to what you talked a little bit about last week. It starts at home, hopefully, you know, with mom and dad cooperating. I mean, Pam and I, even after we divorced, would call each other all the time. Hey, Jana said this, Deborah said that, what did you, you know? If you can do something like that at home and give them at least as firm a foundation as possible, when they go out there and run into a situation where somebody else is behaving badly, quote unquote, yeah, it's like that old saying, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Just because somebody else is behaving badly doesn't mean you need to.
Yeah. Can we go more directly to what can you do as a parent? Let's say it's gotten to this point of disrespect. One of the things we've learned is do your homework ahead of time so that it never comes to this, right? And we've talked about techniques about that. But what I'm trying to get at today is what do you do if you get to this point? We've talked about what a father can do. He can change his behavior, right? Become more loving to his wife. He can talk with his children and say, I have not been a good father up to this point. And with the help of God, I'm going to change the behavior that I have. But can you suggest anything that a mom might be able to do? Let's say it's the case where Gordon is talking about, where the parents are no longer together, and the mom may feel she can talk to her ex-husband to a certain extent, but she's not getting a lot of cooperation. Ladies, what do you think would be a solution to a situation like this that a woman can do in a case like that? Jerry?
Well, I kind of have this problem sometimes. My kids tend to disrespect me because there isn't a father figure there, and the father is very disrespectful to me most of the time. And sometimes they forget, and they'll make fun of me, and I'll be doing something, and they sit there and giggle and laugh, and then I sit them down and I say, I don't appreciate you disrespecting me the way you have. You know, it's you know, you upset me and you're disrespected, and it's not the right way to treat me. I'm not your. It used to be when there's just the three of us in the house that were like all equal. Unfortunately, because they're helping me and we're almost all equal, so they sometimes forget that they have to respect me a little bit more than they do. So we have to sit down and we discuss, and I just tell them, you're disrespected. You know, my oldest one and the youngest one both tend to do that. Like even the older one tends to try to be in charge of me and tell me, well, I'm not parenting right, I'm not doing this right, I'm, you know, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm a parent and you're not, and I appreciate the comments, however,
God has the positive all the authority to do that.
And I am in charge.
Right.
And I can think, I mean, isn't unless you have so bad, if I am in charge and you're not, and this is the way it's going to be. So I guess I have to keep reminding them a lot that you're disrespecting me, you know. And especially my younger one is more disrespected than the other one. And I have to, the other day he was starting in on me, and I just said, why do you think you should disrespect me more than you do someone in the store? Or someone in your friends? I said, I don't deserve any of that, and I think you better back off a little bit. You know, and I'm sorry. And I said, well, just, and so he started this morning. Where's my clothes? Where's my shoe? I'm going to be late. And I said, remember the conversation we had at the park? Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, you're right. And then he did his thing. So you just have to keep reminding them.
Yes, good point. Talk about it. How often haven't our solutions come down to talk, right? Do not allow the behavior to continue. Speak up. Say the things that Jerry has said. I'm the parent and you're not. And this is the way that things are going to be. You cannot disrespect me. God dislikes that. That is wrong for you to do. Talk about it. Can you think of anything else that a lady might do? Let's try to talk to about positive, you know, how can you turn the situation around? Karen, what are you talking
about? I was just thinking something, because I've tried with a teenage son. Right now, anything I say is in one ear, not the other. Nothing, he knows everything. Mm-hmm. But of course, if somebody else tells him, well, they don't. Anything right now, we're in that mode. So I just started, when he started getting in that mode, the thing is, we used to have a deal, I need warm meals a day for him, he needed two. Because one day my boy is the food. So I just decided one morning, he looks at me, Mom, you haven't made my breakfast or lunch. Well, I haven't, I'm sleeping in today. And I just laid there in bed all morning, and he was panicking. He comes home from school, where's my food? Too busy, couldn't get to it. So I just kind of quietly, he had no food, didn't do his laundry for a week, no food. All of a sudden, the next week, Mom, please, could you do this? For a whole week, he had to do his own food, his own laundry, he went hungry. Well, he was crawling back.
Yeah.
And I just grew up quietly.
I call that being on strike.
I just said, why do I have all these excuses? It's a, you show no appreciation. Why should I do this for you? You know, you want somebody to do something for you, you need to show some appreciation.
I think in Karen's situation, I would even link it even more directly to the behavior. And not tell him I don't have time to do this, but you are being disrespectful, and as a result, I'm not going to make the meals for you. I think it would be, she's had an example of her, in her house where it turned around, right? Where the child is demanding, like you were describing, and all of a sudden, did you notice the first word out of his mouth? You know what she was telling me? Please.
Manners.
All of a sudden, manners appear out of nowhere, right? So I think a good thing to do in a case like that would be, when they speak in a disrespectful way, ignore exactly what they're saying. Act as if they're not in the house, as if you're not going to carry out what they say, and when they speak in a well-mannered way, do it right away. Do it with a smile on your face, right? That's just positive reinforcement, right? It's that negative-positive thing that we were talking about. God's law works that way, right? If there's certain things, no, do not do, and you're giving negative reinforcement by standing there and doing nothing, right? That type of tone of voice gets no results. But when the tone of voice is right, when the please and thank yous are there, well, of course I'll do that for you. I love you. You see what I'm saying? That's a pretty simple thing to do when it really comes down to it. What you got to do is try to get the emotion out of the situation as much as you can. Because you'll be tempted to step in, you know, like in Karen's situation, oh, my little baby's getting hungry, you know, I gotta feed him. No, you gotta separate yourself from that and just be able to say objectively, stoically, no, can't do it. Can't reinforce that behavior. But when the proper behavior comes, I reinforce it for all I'm worth. Yeah. Curtis?
I see in my own family, being large and typical of all moms, as the kids are growing up, they do everything for me. Then as they get, like Ellie, she's 13, they still want mom to do everything for them. So there kind of comes a time where the kid has to take more responsibility for themselves,
yeah.
And the mother needs to let go. Otherwise, the kid feels like they're the king or the queen, and I'm bossing my mom, you know, exactly. The mother around, and then they think, hey, that's the way it's always been,
So why not more? If she did this for me when I was 7, 8, 9, hey, I'm 13 now, I have more demands. And so I should tell my mom that she should do more for me because I have more needs. And maybe shift some of that responsibility to the daughter or the son, whoever.
Exactly.
And so they can have their own self-respect instead of disrespecting the mom. And I see that all the time because the mom's want to be a good mom, of course, but doing too much for your teenage kids just starts going the opposite direction.
Exactly. Curtis must have gotten a copy or read my part 6. That's exactly the topic that we're going to have. Because a kid's demands are going to go in this direction, and a parent knows they need to go in this direction at the exact same time. As Curtis was saying, their demands are going to increase. As they grow older, they have more needs. And if you don't shift some of those responsibilities onto themselves, you will become the slave in the castle, and they will become the king. Yes. Yes. Okay, let's go on to our second rubber meets the road. Your child is choosing friends at school who you think are having a bad influence on him or her. When your child's birthday comes up, he or she suggests having these children over to your house. You suggest inviting some of your child's other classmates who would have a more positive influence. Your child says, I don't want to have those kids over. What do you do? We've had a few cases of that crop up from things that you've suggested already. This is one that I took simply because of comments from parents.
I don't know if this is the direction you're heading, but I can tell you in my situation, I had those kids over with the kids that I wanted over.
Mm-hmm.
And laid down the ground rules that this is our home, this is how you will behave, this is what's going to happen, and I had total cooperation.
Really?
So it worked out well.
Excellent.
And discussing the behaviors I didn't like that my child's friend was doing, and how to be a good influence on, and how to maybe, because this is a child of God, this is somebody that, you know, God loves, and we need to, you know, be a good role model for them. Instead of turning into negative, I don't want you hanging around with these kids. Because I remember when I was a kid, I had that situation, and all it does is make you want to hang around.
And then they gravitate to it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So trying to take a, you know, negative situation, turn it to a positive, and it actually was very successful.
The homework solution again, right? You spoke with your child first about the situation, and when the children came, both the desirable and the undesirable, you laid down the ground rules for all of them. So they knew what was permissible in the home and wasn't. Yeah. I think that's a good solution.
It kind of goes along with the thing that I've been emphasizing for you too.
Make sure that your children are with a group of peers that will reinforce the right beliefs and values, but also don't shelter them so much that they don't know how to interact with kids who are a little bit on the edge, right? You really want your children to have both, and that's what Linda did in that situation. She wisely had the meeting of these children take place in her own home, so she could control the ground rules of what was going to happen in the social situation, and it worked out well, she says. Yeah, good solution. Anyone else have one for that? Oh, Gordon?
I can't remember the young man's name, Jason, I think.
Jason.
Mm-hmm. Mentioned something about seeing a third party, using a third party as an example.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Curtis mentioned something last week about many cultures and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Linda gave a great example. If you have some good influence, not so good influence all together, it has an interesting sort of third party effect on your own child, because they get to see an interaction between those two that they might not otherwise notice if they're hanging with one group or the other at that time. And so it gives them a little perspective on where you're coming from. So later or offline, you guys can have a discussion, not directly, like you said, but hey, you know, the other day I noticed that somebody was doing blah, blah, blah. They've had that same experience then.
Yes. And I would amplify what you're saying, Gordon. Do you see how in a situation like Linda set up, she could eventually let go of who's determining the mood at the party by having the kids then say, well, Mrs. Black said that we can't do such and such. And maybe even your own child will come to the conclusion in the setting of the party, boy, this kid really is kind of off the wall. Or, I can't believe he would make that suggestion after my mom laid down the... Do you see what I'm saying? You're then bringing your child over to your point of view so that they articulate it for themselves and can defend it maybe even in front of their own peers, right?
And will probably be more blatant about saying something.
Yes.
Where you're being a little diplomatic.
Right, exactly. An adult wouldn't be able to come out and say it that crassly to the child who's misbehaving, but maybe another child would have the courage to do that. And then the other children in the setting are all kind of encouraged. Well, if he could say that to so-and-so, then I think I can stand up when something's wrong too and say, no, that shouldn't be. Yes. No?
We had a similar type of party, and it was interesting. Those that were less desirable or whatever, they were there, but they also left early. It wasn't the kind of party that they...
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those that remained, and I think Gunnar realized... Mm-hmm. Even though the option was open to many, those that stayed and laughed, you know, we could see they were having a blast and having fun. Mm-hmm. It was self-conclusive for him, I think, in mm-hmm. seeing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The ones that needed this left.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, and the others had a good time so that they could come to the conclusion for themselves. Yes, good behavior really is fun, you know, rather than, yeah.
And it's funny, the ones that came and stayed are ones that we see the parents, they're there, they're at the sporting events, they're chaperoning the dances. The kids that came and were weird and split, I've never seen their parents, couldn't, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, parent involvement is a good indicator, you know, of where the child is at, right? Yeah, good points. Anyone else on this one? Craig?
You also have to, you know, think about, you know, age appropriate, you know, some of the comments that it seems like they're older children, but for younger children, we have just made the decision that this person, you know, this children, you know, child isn't coming over.
Right.
You know, you know, we've just made the decision for the child and not put it in the hands like an older child who might, you know, give an opportunity like you're suggesting.
Yes, age appropriate is very important with this issue because can a little child, can a kindergartner or a first grader process the information well enough to know why this behavior is going to rub off on him or her in a bad way? And, you know, you may just have to say at a certain age, no, this person can't come. Yeah, so each situation is going to have to be judged differently depending on age, depending on the personality of the child. I mean, there are many factors that play into a question like this, right? Jerry?
I just have when my stepdaughter was in high school, we were going somewhere, and this new girl was going to the skating rink. She said, I really never wanted to do it at night, but she begged. This girl at my car, oh my gosh, all the boys are going to pick up and do this. But if you were an 8th grader, I'm going to do this. This girl would never be in my car again. We dropped off, I let her go, and I was really nervous, and we got back in, and I was going to give the big spill. This girl won't be going with you ever again. She didn't say much. I said, how to go? Oh, it was all right. That girl was so out of control, it scared Graciela, and she's like, and then we had a discussion about the girl, and she goes, yeah, I don't know the ones that are anymore. So, I mean, at least she was, if I would have said something in the car, of course, I would have been the bad guy, yeah. So I let it go, but I was a little nervous, but she... Again, she had friends, a lot of friends that way once in a while, and we kind of discussed it, and they kind of would, she'd kind of, you're right. Mm-hmm. You're right, you know, yeah. And kind of go away from them. So yeah. It works.
Sometimes you got to take the risks, though, right?
Unfortunately, yeah. Yes, and hopefully, and if you talk to them enough, they can kind of see, like you said, the party. They know. The kids are, when they're teenagers, they don't want to see it, but if they're coming from your, you know, the family that we're having here, they're going to see it. Mm-hmm. They don't want to admit it, but they're going to see it.
Excellent point. Okay, I think we will move on then to part 6. That was the end of our discussion on relationships. Today we turn toward discipline. I will be handing around the sign-up sheet and circle the number next to your name and add yourself to the bottom of the list if you are new today. Now I want everyone to understand from the beginning of this lesson that when I talk about discipline, I'm not talking specifically about consequences for certain bad behavior. I'm talking more about how to develop self-discipline in your child. How you need to give them certain challenges and struggles in order for them to mature. That's what I'm talking about with discipline. today, okay? Not directly about what we think about, you know, punishments or consequences or whatever it happens to be for a certain bad behavior. I'm talking about raising your children to be self-disciplined Christian people. My first question is in there is, do you see the smaller word in discipline? When I'm teaching, this is the way I always teach the kids. Big Bible terms always have smaller words in them that will help to understand. Do you see the smaller word in discipline? What is it?
Disciple.
Disciple, right? Disciple is in discipline. That's why the whole point of this lesson is going to be, you can't be a disciple of Jesus without having discipline, right? The two are just intimately connected with one another. Disciple and discipline. And I quote there some words from the Bible, the most direct, most famous passage in the whole Bible that talks about discipline. Endure hard, it comes from Hebrews chapter 12. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline. I think you put that part there in parentheses, especially for people who maybe think to themselves, well, I had kind of loosey-goosey parents who never really disciplined me, and I've never really had discipline in my life, and that's why I don't know how to discipline children. I think he put that part in parentheses in there to say, yeah, but then you had to go through the school of hard knocks in a worse way than a child who was disciplined. I think that's what he's trying to get at there. One way or another, we are going to go through discipline, whether it's from our parents, whether it's from the hard knocks in life, whatever it is, everybody goes through discipline. This is not optional in life on planet Earth. If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? See, comparing human fathers now and God the Father. Verse 10, our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good. I'm always intrigued with that wording there where it says about the human fathers, the way they thought best. No human father is perfect. And a human father is going to make mistakes. They're going to do what they think is best. But notice the phrase that goes right after that. But God disciplines us for our good. There can be no question that when God disciplines us, that something good is going to come out of it. Because he's all-knowing, okay? And he knows he's got the eternal perspective. He's going to see how the outcome is going to be at the end of our life on this earth and on into heaven. So he knows all the facts and he disciplines in a perfect way. But God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. You know what phrase parents got from that one, right? This hurts me more than it's going to hurt you. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Righteousness in that it teaches children to confess their sins, to receive forgiveness, to receive Christ's righteousness, and then a sense of peace. A child who has been disciplined, pay attention to the children in your child's classroom someday and ask which ones are the calmest ones in the classroom. I would guess that in most cases, they are disciplined children who have a sense of peace because they're not off the wall, out of control. You see what I'm saying? When a child isn't disciplined, there's the opposite of these two. There's no righteousness around and there's no peace for parents either. We have no peace then if they're not disciplined. Okay, so that's the section from Hebrews, the first one that I wanted to look at. Anything that strikes you before we go on to any of the questions and things about that particular passage? Anything you'd like to comment on?
A little while as they thought best is certainly, that's heavy.
Yeah.
Because it is a very little while.
Yeah.
You get right down to it.
Oh, good phrase. I went completely past that. for a little, our fathers disciplined us for a little while. We really have them in our care for such a little time, don't we?
Well, and even if you think that you're, I mean, they're your children forever, but by the time they're 7 or 8, usually, all the groundwork's been laid. After that, you're just putting up stick construction.
That's right. You're building on the stories. Foundations later by that time, right? Yeah. So it really is a short period that you have to lay the groundwork, right? With a little while, as they thought best. Any other phrases or comments?
No.
I think no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. I think that's the toughest thing as a parent, is the tough love.
Yes.
I mean, I've disciplined before, set a rule or boundary, or, and inside, it's killing me. I think back to the way I was raised, and I think my dad was tough. But I don't hold anything against him as I look back. It wasn't like you or anything. But I think the tough luck is a hard thing in our society, especially where anything goes, and everybody has such an influence on TV.
Where you can get anything you want in this society, and we're trying to teach them to say no. We're going against the tide completely, right? So it's going to be tough in this society.
Yes. I would say, even at this stage, I'm finding things difficult. My mom says one thing. There are other older people like in the congregation that say another thing. You know, the doctor is kind of, they don't really always come down like, this is what you should do. And then the books I read are, modern kind of books. And one says one thing, one says another thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. Finally, it's like, okay, I'm just going to go forward and I'm going to do what I kind of feel is right, because it's hard, it's like with the whole crying thing.
Yes.
How long are you going to cry?
Exactly.
And you finally get to a point where it's like, okay, now I think she's at this age where 20 minutes, it's appropriate. She can cry just because I know she's mad, because nobody's coming in there to pick her up at night. And then once you kind of get that stage down, you're on to a new stage, or her behavior changes, and it's like, well, I just got that down. And the little time thing from there, too, is...
Just you wait.
Exactly.
It's never ending.
I think that's why it says, as they thought best. Don't put too much pressure on yourself to be the best psychologist in the world and the best, you are simply the parent of that child, and you do the best with what you've got. You get all the guidance that you can from God's word, from people you respect, and then you just go ahead and you do it. Do your best. I know exactly what you're talking about. I did a lot of babysitting. It probably strikes you as odd that a boy would do babysitting. Already from the time I was in the 8th grade, I would babysit for one cousin in general, and she said, for the little one about the size of Phoebe, put him in bed and just let him cry himself to sleep. No matter how long he cries, just let him in it. So I had him in there for 2, maybe 3 hours. Just wailing the entire time, and I was constantly struggling and getting it, but she said, and I finally got him up, and he was in a state. But you do the best with what you've got. Mark.
Well, one of the things that strikes me here, and I think this is also written for us as parents, if you are not disciplined, never mind the word discipline, you are illegitimate children, not true sons. I think they're also talking to us as parents, because we are the ones who have to set the standard and have the discipline to stay at that standard with our children.
Yes.
Because our children are unrelenting in trying to bring the standard down all the time.
Exactly.
And it seems like the outside world. So to stay at the standard is true discipline for a parent.
Yes. So what Mark is saying is, actually, this lesson is meant for us as much as it is for our children, right? We need to learn discipline to say, this is where God's standard is, and I'm not going to compromise on this.
That's right? The way you're righteousness and peace.
Back to the team of that, America. Karen?
I think that fits into, because I write for especially young children, 7 and under, modeling is the best teacher for them, because they imitate everything that they see and hear. And so if you're acting appropriately, they tend to follow in that path without even having
the time. Exactly. If you show the righteousness and peace, they want to guide.
That's probably the best point I can say as an old guy, what you just brought up. Jana was not even two yet, sitting in the car seat right behind me, and I was going to pull out onto a four-lane boulevard with islands in the middle, so there were two lanes coming my way. And a space opened up, but then somebody moved over from the number one lane into the number two lane. So I had to wait, and I went, damn, and she went, damn, without missing a beat. Just like that.
To yourself, yeah.
But that's one of the things I struggled with, is when I would say something, good or bad, especially Janet, she's very verbal, and boy, she'd pick up on it right away. And that was a big lesson for me. I went,
yeah.
Damn. And she went, damn, without even missing a breath.
Yeah. Self-control, right? That's what this lesson is all about. Curtis.
Before Tiger Woods hit the tour, you know, his dad came out the year before and said, my son is going to do this and this and this and this. And all the sports writers kind of said, you're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. But then the year when Tiger Woods hit the tour, none of those sports writers ever went back to Tiger Woods' dad and says, you know what, you were right. But Tiger Woods' father disciplined him, not just on the physical side, but on the mental side, because he was from the military. And he's been able to achieve greatness because of that discipline. Mm-hmm. But using his sports as an example, Tiger Woods' father would never pick up his bag, pick up any of the equipment. He told Tiger that playing golf is a privilege. It's not a right. Like all of our kids, we play sports. So I kind of take heed to that. So in case if we go to golf or Little League, I'm not picking up his gear. I'm not carrying his bag. I go, that's your privilege to play this sport. If you don't want to pick up your gear, if you don't want to, you know, put your bat or your glove where you can find it at home, well, hey, you're going to look for it. I'm not looking for it because you're the person that's participating in the sport.
Yes.
I'm just here to take you there.
Yes.
And so, if we have to wait or whatever, and then, let's say if we have conflict where he has a game or there's a church function and he has to be there late to practice or to the game, I tell him, hey, you go to your coach and you tell him what happened. And if you didn't get your homework done, you go tell him. I'm not telling him. I go, that's your responsibility. So, sure, it's a lot easier if I call the coach up. I can get it done a lot faster. But I'm not going to do it because I want him not just to respect himself, but I want him to respect the coach. I want him to respect his opportunity to play. And if he doesn't, then I can sit there at home and, you know, not have to take him or not have to be out there to watch him. So if you start out young like that, when he gets older, he already knows the rules. And he knows that, hey, you know, Pop's not going to help me get my golf bag out. And I'm not going to help him put it back in the car either. And, you know, he might struggle with it, but he's going to have to learn how to do it sometime.
Good point. As privileges increase, responsibilities must increase right along with it, right? Simply because your child has more tasks in school doesn't mean that you help them more with doing it. That's the wrong way of thinking. I use a sports analogy in here too, you will see it. Too many parents want to run interference for their children, right? Their children they're the quarterback or the running back or whatever the star is of that particular play, and parents are out there to just get rid of all the trouble for them, right? So they can be the star of the show. No. Your role becomes more and more to stand on the sideline and to be the coach who encourages them, who doesn't see to it that they don't get knocked down and, you know, get out of here, don't knock my kid down. You watch them get knocked down, and you are right balance it, now get up, come on. That is your role, to encourage them to handle the tougher things that are coming their way, not to make the road smooth for them. Yeah. One thing that crystallized in my mind as I was writing this particular lesson was the interrelation of the two S words, struggle and success. Do you realize that you can't have success unless you have a struggle? There is no such thing as success unless you first go through the struggle. That's how the world is set up, and that is one of the main things you need to teach your child, not to avoid the struggle, not to have somebody else step in and get rid of the struggle for you so that you can shine with all the wonderful talents you have. Nobody parents like going, oh, my child is so bright, you know. And don't tell them they're bright. Tell them they have wonderful gifts from God. Come at it from a different angle, but make sure they're struggling with those gifts that they have. Okay?
It's you, Tom.
Oh, okay.
Just another quick sports analogy. And I know you know this because of confirmation, but our daughter's playing volleyball, and because confirmation, you have to drive to get the confirmation by 5 o'clock, she can't be there for all of her volleyball practice on Mondays. And it's interesting, this is kind of a Christian discipline and the world's discipline together, but it's a good lesson for Morgan. She goes to volleyball practice just at the very beginning and has to leave. Jenny takes her confirmation. And they play on Tuesdays and Thursdays their games. And the volleyball coach said, well, can they get confirmation class moved to Friday afternoons? Well, obviously, you know, we couldn't. And we said, well, that's probably not going to happen. But Morgan's a decent player, and she starts, but on the Tuesday game she doesn't start because she misses practice. Mm-hmm. And that's discipline showing from the coach's standpoint to the other players, mm-hmm. hey, this player wasn't here, so and it's kind of a good lesson for Morgan. She knows that her Christian discipline is more important than the worldly discipline, mm-hmm. but she's seeing both of them cross over. Mm-hmm. So it's a good lesson for Morgan, and we talk about it. And so, I don't know how much her friends see that. Who knows how the Holy Spirit's working out there?
Yes.
But, you know, that may have an impact on a parent or one of the friends somewhere down the line or the coach. Who knows? But it's a great thing for Morgan how they both cross over. And she's accepted it pretty. I mean, she bugs her a little bit, but you know, you say, you know, you're in eighth grade, you don't start, so what?
Yeah.
Like, what's the longer goal here? So, anyway.
Excellent. Thanks for sharing that example with us. Yeah. Sam's basketball team this year, I kept encouraging every time they have a loss, and they lost every game. But, you know, you got to find the positive things in that situation. I'd rather have losing in fifth grade than winning, so that the big head doesn't develop or the, you know, but there's life lessons that can be learned from every child.
Here. There's just one thing that our manager gave us, and one of the chapters was the monkey and giraffe, and it was for adults, it was for management on letting your manager, letting the people that work with you get the monkey off of your back. It's not your problem. They have to fix their own problems. They'll keep coming to you constantly.
Oh, yeah.
And you're wasting your day by fixing their problems.
There you go.
But it kind of comes from teaching your kids to fix your problems, because if you don't, and then they give you a job, and you're the manager, everything is your problem.
Yes.
Not their problem.
Yeah.
It's a really good book. And,
because as your children grow, then your problems would increase exponentially, right? If you had to solve every problem for them as well as your own. So from little on, they need to be taught to get the monkey off their own head.
Right, and it was in there also. One of the chapters is about when you were younger, you maybe not even younger, probably. When you played Little League, you got there yourself. I mean, it wasn't like where we live today, or
yeah,
anywhere.
Right, so far, yeah.
But you had to go to the bike and you went and played, or you went and did all this.
Yes.
Now all of a sudden the monkey's in my back, because I got to go on time, I got to pick them up. Just like you were saying about the bag, the minutes and everything, that's all of a sudden my responsibility, and I'm not playing really.
Yeah.
But then all those hand in hand, all for your job. You take responsibility, the managers are like, what'd you do today? All I did was put out fires for
somebody else. Staff. Yeah. Yeah, how can you be productive then?
Yeah.
If you're constantly putting out fires for somebody else, right? Yeah. Okay, going on. After the Hebrews passage there in the middle of the page, sometimes people get a false impression about the freedom that Jesus came to bring us. They think that it is a liberation from everything bad, a liberation from all unpleasant tasks. Sometimes they view it as a freeing of the human spirit. They think that once they become believers, they will always be optimistic, enthusiastic, and eager to do what's good, and that this positive thinking will make everything in life go well for them. At some point, we've all had those naive thoughts, right? But that's how Christianity is, right? I sometimes say to people in the Bible information class, when we're getting close to the end, if you think it's going to get easy now, you are sadly mistaken. Jesus didn't die for us so that everything may be easy for us in life. It's just not the way it works. Jesus offered a much more realistic view of discipleship. He said in Luke 9, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself. That's part of discipline, isn't it? Denying your own needs. You who are parents know that as well as I do, right? When you have that little extra life that got attached to you, boy, your freedoms and your desires went out the window, didn't they? Because you have 24 hours a day of being attached to the needs of an infant. An infant who cannot help himself or herself in the least. That's exactly what Jesus was talking about. Denying yourself, your own desires, and take up your cross daily and follow me. Being a follower of Jesus involves cross-bearing, right? The difficulties, the hardships. Jesus' view of discipleship involves self-denial and daily cross-bearing. Let's see how this applies to parents. Discipline and parenting. Every father and mother would like their children to have it better in life than they had. It's a natural instinct in parents to protect their children. But shielding children from too many of life's natural struggles leaves children poorly equipped to face a fast-paced, stressful, sinful world. The generation that grew up during the Great Depression and World War II was especially determined to spare their children the suffering they themselves had lived through. A booming economy after World War II and advances in science allowed their children to escape the effects of poverty, high infant mortality rates, diseases like polio, etc. Do you realize, most of us are baby boomers in this room, I think, do you realize what a make-believe world we grew up in? I'm somebody, I've shared with you before, interested in history, especially family history. The first generation of fat parents to come to America, they lost 8 of their 12 children in childhood. Can you imagine what life would be like losing a child that often? I cannot begin to imagine. We grew up in a world where we were inoculated from anything that would harm us. Things like polio, I mentioned there. The economic boom after World War II was unprecedented in the history of the world. You know, we grew up under some pretty pampered situations for the most part. Children cannot succeed without struggling. I forgot one sentence up there. But this artificial man-made well-being led to other problems like a high divorce rate and drug abuse problems, right? Those things cropped up at the exact same time as parents were thinking, I'm going to make life better for my children. Children cannot succeed without struggle. If we as parents reduce every struggle that faces our children, they will not have what it takes to succeed when they are on their own. As our children grow, we need to move away from the urge to run interference for them and to view ourselves more and more as coaches who are at their side when they are not done, encouraging to pick themselves up and to continue the race. How do Christian parents teach things like self-discipline and self-control in our affluent, easy times? Here are some starters. And our time is just about up, so I'm just going to give you an overview of the rest. Please read it, and we will finish this lesson for next time. You might smile a little bit when you see what I have after my arrows, because they're very simple, almost folksy things to do in order to build self-discipline. First one, teach your children delayed gratification. If there's anything that the world is destroying for our children, it's the sense that you have to wait for something good, or you have to work for it. We're going to talk in that section about how to delay gratification. As they grow older, they have a longer time span where they can go between rewards or compliments or whatever it is. And consciously be doing that to spread that time out so that they begin to be self-motivated people rather than, I've got to have a little doggy treat for every time I jump through the hoop. Teach delayed gratification. Look down at the next one. Teach responsibility by giving your children regular household chores. I can't emphasize this one enough. Since the dishwasher and everything moves into the kitchen, it's kind of not really helpful to children.
Excellent. Teach your children how to manage money is an important one. Top of the next page. Reward responsible behavior with freedom. The best, most appreciated gift you will give your children is when you can say to them, now, I've got this project for you, but you take it and you run with it. I cannot believe the freedom my parents gave me when I was a teenager. I was from age of, they sent me away to a Lutheran high school when I was 14 years old. When I was 16, they gave me a car to go live in a whole different city, an hour and a half away from where we live. When I look back on it, I think, what were they doing giving that kind of freedom? Well, they had done homework ahead of time. I had been driving since the age of 12, driving a tractor on the farm. Responsibility has to go together with freedom. And then you can give your children much more freedom than you would ever think that you could give them. Next one. Here's a big one. Don't make excuses for your children's bad behavior. Parents are so prone to stepping in as soon as that child is something wrong.